How does AI even work? Where does creativity come from? What's the secret to living longer? TED Radio Hour explores the biggest questions with some of the world's greatest thinkers. They will surprise, challenge, and even change you. Listen to NPR's TED Radio Hour wherever you get your podcasts.
WBEZ's nonprofit Spotlight is supported by UChicago Medicine, providing expert primary and urgent care with locations throughout Chicagoland. Their walk-in urgent care locations offer a variety of services for adults and kids 7 days a week. No appointment needed. And for the visits that can wait a day or two, flexible hours and online scheduling make it possible to find a primary care provider partner. Learn more at uchicagomedicine.org.
I'm Sasha Ann Simons, and this is Reset. We're coming up to the end of 2024, and it's been a busy week. On Reset, we covered the end of the dramatic city budget debate. We talked to Cook County Board President Tony Preckwinkle about a much-needed overhaul of the county's property tax system. We also talked about the best books and the best food that we ate in 2024, and a federal proposal to protect monarch butterflies across the country. Okay, but now we're diving into the biggest stories of the week for our weekly news recap. Stories like these.
The whole point of an elected school board was constituents saying they wanted 21 members to work together for the betterment of our children, the betterment of our schools, and the protection of our tax dollars.
Voting is now closed.
27 yeas, 23 nays. This motion passes.
After 2 months of bitter debate, the Chicago City Council just approved next year's budget.
We have passed a budget that does not cut services, that does not cut jobs, that does not raise property taxes.
We checked in with Chalk Beach Chicago Bureau Chief Becky Vivi, Better Government Association President David Greising, and Chicago Sun-Times government and politics reporter Mitchell Armentrout. We started by talking about city politics and how the year has been for Mayor Brandon Johnson. I asked, where do you all think he is with his progressive campaign promises?
Well, one of his progressive campaign promises was no property tax hike. He winds up with no property tax hike, despite trying to impose a property tax hike. I don't think you can mark that as a win for him. The budget was the most difficult budget in living memory, and a lot of that really lands on his desk. So I would say that that's what sticks in our mind at this point.
Mm-hmm. Thoughts, Mitch?
Yeah, I think it sort of ends as just sort of a terrible, no good, very bad year for Brandon.
Terrible, no good, very bad.
Yeah,
okay.
Not ideal.
Tell us more, Mitch.
You know, it just kind of felt like from, at least from our side and the media, you know, this just kind of watching the wheels fall off at a lot of points, you know, just kind of a revolving door in his, a lot of his different agencies. You know, not able to get a lot of these progressive policies across the finish line. You know, he laid out a really big vision when he was elected last year, and I think he's kind of run into some of the realities of trying to govern in a city like Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And I think he hasn't shown a real skill at building those coalitions behind the scenes and just kind of seeing a lot of these ugly sort of the budget battle that we just went through. I mean,
yeah.
It's just not something that we're used to seeing, and he kind of frames it as a new way of doing things, which is a clever PR spin, but
right.
I think it might be a little bit more indicative of, not the most effective leadership skills.
True. Before we dig more into that budget, Becky, I mean, what comes to mind for you when you think of the year that Brandon Johnson has had?
Well, if I throw it all the way back to, I'm thinking of March, one of his top progressive promises was the Bring Chicago Home tax, a tax on higher end, more expensive properties to help fund homeless services. And that wasn't even an internal governing politics situation. That was the voters, giving a clear no to that. And
yeah, it was a referendum aiming to generate $100 million a year.
That was a big blow to go from that a year ago getting into the runoff to then that moment for him. I think you said it correctly.
Pretty big setback.
No good, very bad, difficult year.
It's almost come full circle, too, because that was sort of the epitome of, progressive taxing system, taking wealth taxing the wealthy to benefit some of Chicago's most vulnerable populations.
Mm-hmm.
And here we end up with a budget that passed that is really loaded with regressive taxes across the board, just in terms of, Uber surcharges and streaming service surcharges, just you know, kind of nickel and diming folks that are going to hit lower incomes harder. Exactly.
Right.
And let's add to it, too, the Springfield relationship. He went down to Springfield to say that the state owes Chicago Public Schools $1 billion and came back with nothing in his pocket. Mm-mm. And his seeming desire to be at odds with Governor Pritzker when he really needs Pritzker in order to get a lot of his agenda accomplished has been really kind of a self-inflicted wound.
Mm-hmm. And didn't maybe see, I'm not surprised he didn't see coming or make more of a plan for the end of all of the federal COVID relief money that is hitting the school system and certainly the city as well, and not kind of trying to map out a plan or a strategy beyond, hey, Springfield, send us more.
Well, you know, and even as we talk about the mayor's revised budget that did end up passing, but of course, after weeks and weeks of debate, I wonder, David, if folks listening might still remember when city council would unanimously approve a mayor's budget. Do you remember those days when it was basically a rubber stamp?
Well, we remember them because we grew up in that life. I mean, that the city council has been historically a rubber stamp for all the Chicago mayors, including even Mayor Lightfoot, had pretty
similar budgets. So are those days just gone for good?
Well, part of it is the difficulty of the budgets right now. $1 billion budget deficit, which is what Mayor Johnson was facing, is difficult to close. The thing is, he's got a $1.1 billion budget deficit coming next year, a $1.2 billion deficit coming the year after. So the mayors need to be able to handle that kind of problem. We do have this move toward a more independent council, but we have that move not because it's good government, which it is, but because we have a mayor who is so ineffective at his job. He came with a budget a couple of weeks late, which set the whole process behind. Mm-hmm. He came with some unrealistic notions. He came dead set against a property tax increase, then had to throw a $300 million idea out there, with then got rejected by an unprecedented 50-0 vote against that idea.
Yeah.
And so that just bespeaks an inability to work behind the scenes with city council in advance of delivering a budget, much less in the give and take of a real negotiation. He declared himself
collaborator in chief,
and then refused to collaborate with anybody. So it was very perplexing.
And this whole budget battle is really just, he's kind of sacrificed any clout he had. I mean, when you just sort of accede to all these major pushback from the council, I mean, how do you enter 2025 expecting to, you know, have any real force behind your own proposals?
Mm-hmm. You also have to remember that Lightfoot came before Johnson, one-term mayor. Rahm Emanuel was a two-term mayor. But prior to that, Richard M. Daley ruled for, 26, 27 years? Mm-hmm. And so you had a situation where by virtue of that longevity, baked into it was sort of this stability and this, I don't want to say autopilot kind of system, but the rubber stamping council on a very strong mayor for many years was what the reality was for so long.
Yeah, it's been a pretty combative council, causing some to even compare it to the days of council wars under Harold Washington. I mean, has anyone been surprised by the mayor's strained relations with these alders?
I think it's surprising how much it's played out in the public. Again, like as we keep on saying, you know, these are battles that over the last few generations really happened behind closed doors in city council. And now everything is being played out on Twitter and in our news stories. Mm-hmm.
yes.
You know, I think there is something to be said for what David said. I mean, a stronger city council is good for government. And, you know, obviously this is more of a symptom of perhaps ineffective management skills behind the scenes. But, you know, if this breeds more independence down the road, maybe we can find some positive nuggets.
It's been surprising. I was surprised by, in this budget fight, the types of aldermen who did peel off, who were the progressive in the same camp.
Like the ones who started to go against
that
him.
That started to occur within the progressive camps was sort of interesting to me and surprising. That was surprising. I think there would have been conflict with certain factions of that council, you know, the minute he stepped in 2 years ago. But those recent kind of fissures between progressives like Andre Vasquez and even Maria Haddon, who voted in favor of the budget, but then, you know, gave quite a speech on the city council floor saying this process has irreparably damaged.
And that's the question. And that's the question going forward: is this a one-off or is this the new way? And mm-hmm. it looks, in some respects, like it is the new way, given some of the comments that were made during the debate about the lack of trust. Something must have happened behind the scenes mm-hmm. that we're not aware of promises made and not kept, et cetera. We know there was a ton of horse trading that was going on as mm-hmm. he tried to get.
Yeah, things seem to have really exploded at a certain point. Yeah,
and,
for sure.
And also behind the scenes, we had a group of older people who were preparing their own alternative budget, which never was brought forward. We had demands for information that was not produced by the mayor. So there, a lot of lessons were taken away, I think, by members of council that right. they're thinking next time around, we're going to kind of be in the driver's seat more mm-hmm. than we ever have.
Now, it isn't just alders that Johnson had strained relations with. Now, his attempts to oust the CEO of Chicago Public Schools, that made headlines, Becky. We learned yesterday about a special school board meeting that is scheduled for tonight.
Yes.
What is on the agenda?
So there are two items on the agenda we've not seen in previous agendas ever, which are the consideration of the termination of the chief executive officer, as well as it's very brief, something like settlement of chief executive officer. I don't have the agenda in front of me.
So they're trying to vote on firing Pedro Martinez
yes.
tonight.
So those two items indicate they are going to be considering. They may punt a vote, but it's on the agenda and they could call it. And they certainly, that is what we're, you know, expecting is going to be taken up this evening. And this would, you know, bring kind of the beginning of the end of months long tensions between Pedro Martinez and Mayor Brandon Johnson, who made it known to him earlier this year that he wanted him to depart from mm-hmm. the school district. And, you know, Pedro Martinez has declined that and
right.
has
over
said,
and over.
I'm going to stay. And I believe that, you know, I came here to help and run this district. This is a person who came up in the Chicago Public Schools, a graduate of Juarez High School, and mm-hmm. was a leader in other big districts across the country and returned home under Mayor Lori Lightfoot in 2021 and has a contract to be around right. till 2026. And so this tension and this vote tonight is
well, here's
very
the thing. We've all
intense.
Seen this before, right? We're all journalists in the room. We've all seen politicians schedule that Friday evening press conference yeah. and they hope to get as little media attention as possible.
So they initially had it at 11. But then they had to amend the agenda and due to, you know, open meetings requirements.
But Becky, it's the Friday before Christmas.
I know, Sasha. I know.
You know, CPS students and teachers, they're already going to be on vacation
yep.
And
yep.
some are likely going to be on the road heading out of town. Yeah. What do you think of that, David?
Well, I think he's been trying to do this since October. So if he was going to try to do it quietly with anybody without anybody noticing.
It wasn't ever going to happen.
Do that a little while ago.
Nothing quiet
nice
happening these days.
And this one's going to get attention regardless of whenever you do it. You do it in the middle of the night, it's still going to get pretty careful
yeah.
coverage.
Yeah.
But this kind of chaos, Mitch, right before Christmas, what do you think that's going to do for his relationship with city council?
I don't think it's going to do him any more favors. I mean, we've already seen just a parade of aldermen who have voiced their support for Pedro Martinez. We've seen other elected officials kind of chime in here.
Mm-hmm.
I thought it was interesting to see Alexi Janulius offering his 2 cents yesterday in support of Pedro Martinez. I think that probably nods to Alexi's future political aspirations more than anything. But, Brandon Johnson is obviously, he's kind of banking on folks sort of forgetting about this over the next 2 weeks.
Being on airplanes.
80% of the principals in the system, I think, have signed a letter asking
yes.
them to retain Martinez.
Yes.
We've had some of the newly elected school board members who take office in January
right.
saying, please don't do this.
Yes.
Just really leave this
right.
up to us. I mean, everybody but the people within Johnson's inner circle and the CTU
correct.
Who are closely advising him seem to be wanting him to kind of stand down on
yes,
it.
Well, Becky,
exactly.
speaking of the school board, Monday, Johnson did announce his remaining picks for spots on the school board and board president. Can you tell us who some of these people are?
Yeah, sure. We're still missing one, but, and I'll remind folks that, you know, with the school board elections that just occurred, you all elected 10 people and the mayor gets to appoint 11, a board president, and then the other 10 have to come from the same districts as the elected people, but they have to live on the opposite side. So
got it.
Got you all up to speed really quickly there. And four of the people he appointed last month are going to stick on. They're going to stay on. And then he appointed four or six more people
I'm sorry, he pointed five more people, and we're missing somebody in District 8 still.
Okay.
Some of the notable folks, so he, one of the people is a pastor from Pilsen, and the... these are mostly people who have been in the activist space. One, Olga Bautista, is far on the far southeast side in District 10. She'll be opposite Che Rheinfest, who we heard at the top of the show, who won the election in District 10. This is a sprawling, long South Lakefront district. Olga, activist who's spoken out against a lot of environmental concerns down there in the southeast.
Sean Hardin.
Sean Hardin is the new board president. I don't have the list in front of me. I should have pulled that up. You probably have it in front of you.
I do.
Sean Hardin, Mikayla Blaze. These, again,
there are a lot. Yeah, Debbie Pope, Ed
Bannon. Debbie Pope, who considered a run. There's also two folks I remember by name, Anusha Thokatura and Karen Zakor, who both came in second. They ran for elected seats, but didn't obviously get enough votes. But they were the runner-ups in their district, so they'll be representing District 4 and District 6 on the opposite side of the winner.
Well, all of these were handpicked by Johnson, so does it mean it's likely that they're going to side with him in this power struggle with Martinez?
Presumably. But I'll also remind folks that he appointed seven people in 2023 who all resigned a few months ago because they didn't want to, you know, oust the CEO.
Is tonight's meeting open to the public?
It is open to the public, yes, and it will be live streamed. The folks who are in, I would presume that most of these 11 will be, you know, in alignment with him, and he will maintain influence and power over the schools during this hybrid period, which runs for two more years. He also, there are a few folks who were elected that had endorsements from the CTU, which is a close ally, obviously, of his.
Exactly.
And so we count about 15 of the 21 that are in alignment
with
on
him.
Policy and, you know, vision for the school district. But we could see some shifting. We already have seen at least one of those CTU endorsed candidates
before.
Who've said, you know, she's not into this oust Pedro Martinez.
For
Jenny Kester up on the northwest side has said she's not in agreement with that. And she had run with the endorsement of the union.
David, what are your thoughts on this list here?
Well, the 15 out of 21, I think, is right. But as Becky says, this is very much in flux. And I think one of the surprising elements of the election was that the non-CTU candidates, the school choice and charter-backed people, did so well. And also
some independence.
So there is some independent mindedness, and we won't know until it all shakes out. But for the next year or so, it really likely will still be a Johnson dominated school board.
So I want to also remind us that the teachers are still without a contract. They had hoped to have a contract approved this year. Doesn't seem to be happening. I mean, if the board does get rid of Martinez tonight, well, what would need to happen for a teacher's contract to pass before December 31st?
That is a really great question. I don't know. I am very reluctant to say that that's even possible because there is still a lot of active bargaining, from my understanding, and just based on who, you know, is at the table, and, you know, it's not necessarily Pedro Martinez and Stacey Davis Gates sitting there trying to hash it out, you know, so his departure, you know, doesn't necessarily halt what's going on there. And they also were, at least they had been in active mediation based on, you know, a process set out in labor law at the state level that says, like, you know, I think in October, late September, they had entered into this sort of mediation period. So they've been in that, and that's still playing out. So I don't know that getting a contract by Christmas. I know that they're trying to ramp up that urgency.
For sure.
And they've been, you know, drawing on the national political headwinds as a reason for it. But I don't know. I still see that timeline being soonest mid to late January.
Right. For the past few months, we and the rest of the country have been following the corruption trial of former Illinois House Speaker Michael Madigan. There have been a lot of ups and downs, so I asked David to give us the latest.
Well, the highlight of this week was the testimony of Eddie Acevedo, who was part of Mike Madigan's leadership team in the state legislature. And after he retired in 2016, he was looking for work, and Madigan, it is alleged, as part of his effort to exert his influence or take advantage of his powerful position, was offering lobbying, kind of no-work lobbying jobs to his cronies and leaning on, through the offices of Michael McLean, his co-defendant in the case, offering and leaning on companies that needed legislation to pass to hire these lobbyists to really do almost no work for them. And Eddie Acevedo's testimony was in many respects quite sad because he is suffering from dementia, and it's evident that he probably doesn't remember a lot of what he was being asked about. But what was in testimony was his grand jury testimony, which occurred before some of his faculties were gone. And his grand jury testimony makes pretty clear that he did pretty much no work for AT&T as a paid lobbyist for them. He was paid more than $100,000 by the utility. Mm-hmm. AT&T had a couple of big pieces of legislation. One of the key one is the requirement to have copper landlines in for basically all of their customers, which is quite expensive, and the technology is really no longer needed. So the defense has started to put on its case, and the defense has called a couple witnesses who really, I think, are holding up relatively well in the sense that what the government needs to prove, especially given a recent Supreme Court ruling, is that Madigan's political favors for people needed to be done as part of a quid pro quo. I will do this if you do that.
Right.
And it needs to be done before that happens. Gifts afterward, like giving somebody a lobbyist job, maybe because Madigan did something in return for something Madigan did, that's called a legal gratuity now under a recent Supreme Court ruling. And so the bar is sort of high on this case. And the defense is clearly building a case to say this was all just politics. This was trying to curry favor with Mike Madigan, but nothing illegal was done.
Right.
And that's what we're seeing come to a head now in these closing days of the trial.
Interesting. What has stood out for you so far in the trial overall, Mitch?
I think it's just been really fascinating to sort of see how these politicians and lobbyists talk to each other in emails and phone calls. Like you're saying, David, I mean, Eddie Acevedo, who was previously convicted of tax evasion, just kind of comes across as sort of like out of central casting for really just kind of slimy political business in this whole scenario.
Mm-hmm.
I was in the courtroom last week, actually, with John Seidel, our federal courts reporter. And it's just kind of fascinating to see Mike Madigan in the room with Mike McLean, you know, these two power brokers for a couple generations in Springfield, you know, sitting in a courtroom for 8 hours at a time. I feel for the jurors because it's as, you know, egregious as some of these emails look when you see them on a big screen in a courtroom, it can be difficult to sort of tie those dots together and kind of keep the line of, you know,
I mean, there's so many details coming up. I think that's what it is for me. It's just so incremental.
So much minutia.
Yeah.
And I'm curious to see what the jurors are going to be on break here for about a week or so with the holidays.
Yeah.
I'm curious to see what impact that might have on, or if it has any, you know, on the case, just because there's so much information to keep track of, and that's a long time to. I mean, maybe you probably need a rest from that, to be honest, but just
true.
So much to digest.
Well, Becky, do you think that this could have any lasting impact on how the government is run in Illinois? Just sort of watching things play out here.
I don't have an answer for that. I'm just over here like eating popcorn, waiting for Mitch's like HBO Max series about this trial to be written. Can I be a writer on it?
Unfortunately, it would be like it would be a really dull HBO Max series.
Well,
just
that's the thing.
So,
you gotta like zhuzh it up.
I know.
Zhuzh
it
up.
You've got
that's
a lot
difficult.
Of detail, don't you? You
have well, so much detail. David's our zhuzher. Well, David's our zhuzher.
David, you're going to be executive producer.
Right. To Mitch's point, though, in the Burke trial, you had these memorable phrases like, did you land the tuna? Like, that goes down in the lore of corruption in the state of Illinois. Madigan is so circumspect in all respects, and the little tape segments that you think, yeah, maybe that's a gotcha, there's also, in most cases that I'm hearing and reading about, it seems like there's an alternative explanation that is scummy, but probably not illegal. And it's going to be a challenging case, partly because of the complexity, but partly because I don't know if they really just have him cold.
It's not a sexy case at the end of the day.
I mean, he was always such a less is more type of
right.
leader.
Famously cautious.
You know?
Yeah, I don't know what kind of leader. When I got here, he was already in trouble.
The most interesting thing so far, new revelation, was that he had a punching bag in his office with a picture of Governor Bruce Rauner on it.
So another big local story in 2024. How could we forget this? It was our city hosting the DNC, the Democratic National Convention. It did not lead to the Democratic candidate winning the White House, as we now know. But it did put Chicago in the national and international limelight, I think. And now we've had some months, I think, to reflect on that. How do you all think we did? How did our city do?
Our city showed well. Our city is beautiful in front of a camera, and that's
Isn't it really great?
But I think what more substantively, the big question was about the preparedness for any demonstrations and how those would be handled. There was kind of one major set to, which happened right in front of the Ogilvy Center, where the Israeli consulate is, and there were some anti-Gaza protesters. By all accounts, and looking at a lot of videotape on this and having read a lot about what tactics are appropriate in the circumstance, Chicago police did quite well in that circumstance. They responded as more or less by textbook fashion and were able to handle that without any major problems. So I think by and large, pretty good.
Yeah, I think it, as we found here in this hour, you know, it's easy to kind of go through the news of 2024 and really just kind of slam Brandon Johnson left and right. But you got to hand it to him that by all accounts, I mean, this convention really went off without a hitch. I think a lot of the credit goes to CPD Superintendent Larry Snelling for, you know, being being on the front lines with his rank and file officers during the protests over 4 days. But yeah, I mean, it was really clean. It looked great on TV. And,
yeah, our food looked great. Our streets were clean.
How about that roll call? That was fun.
Yes, that was fun. Yeah. The convention put Governor Pritzker in the national spotlight too. Remember that? I mean, do you think that he's going to continue to get this type of national attention in 2025 as we gear up for a second Trump administration?
He's definitely gunning for that kind of national attention. He used this to set up a potential presidential run, even not knowing in advance whether President Biden would run for re-election. He made the list of vice presidential finalists. That maybe was just a courtesy interview. But nevertheless, his name is now in the list. But it will be a crowded list next time. And whether he, I think there is some disappointment among those who are close to him that he didn't break through in a bigger way. So he still will have a considerable amount of work to do. It's one of the reasons why when Rahm Emanuel is returning from Japan, he's already given interviews in which he's indicated he sort of hopes he will back Pritzker if he runs for re-election. But if he doesn't, Rahm's ready to go.
He's ready to go.
And
yeah.
that's a way to signal, like, Governor, maybe some of his advisors are telling the governor, maybe you should step down and spend full time running for president, not having to worry about the encumbrances of the job.
Also, if you, you know, look at what we're seeing in a lot of the national political conversation, especially with the Democratic Party reflecting and looking inward, and even Rahm Emanuel did several national media interviews unpacking, like, how did that compare to maybe like when he helped the Congress flip Democratic in 2006? And what do Democrats need to do to sort of connect with working class voters, or, you know, this great giant middle that clearly, you know, went toward Trump? And so I think that question of is J.B. Pritzker and all of his, you know, he kind of rose to the national stage in a lot of the ways during COVID because of his COVID response. But I think that also shifted sentiments in a lot of places that led to this outcome of a second Trump term.
Right.
And so I think as the Democrats decide what direction they're going to go as a party, who is the kind of candidate they need? Is it a J.B. Pritzker type? I don't know.
That is the big question. There were also a lot of concerns around DNC time that the convention was going to be disrupted by Texas Governor Greg Abbott. He was sending migrants up to Chicago at the time, but that didn't end up really happening, right, Mitch?
No, and I think that's one of the, I mean, one of the most interesting sort of news narratives of the year, just the way the migrant influx has really slowed down since President Biden toughened up on some of his deportation policies at the southern border. Obviously, that was basically the top concern in Chicago heading into the year. And, I mean, that influx has steadied to a trickle. you know, we didn't see the big buses coming in like mm-hmm. Greg Abbott had threatened for months and had been sending for months. I think it it's that certainly shows, you know, what Joe Biden was trying to do to sort of a when he was still in the presidential race, trying to show a tougher stance at the border.
And Becky Chalkby wrote a lot about mm-hmm. attempts to make room for migrant students in Chicago public schools. What's the very latest on that?
Well, we're still reporting on this. This is something, one of the things we'll be watching in 2025, because we do know, you know, enrollment finally kind of steadied off and stabilized in part because we saw an influx of migrant students enrolling mm-hmm. in the public schools here. I can say anecdotally, we've heard, you know, a number of stories of many of them are not in the district anymore. Maybe they've gone out to the suburban districts or other states or have moved on. That's been true of a lot of the migrants who ended up in these major cities have now dispersed from them as well. But, you know, Chicago Public Schools still has a number of schools that don't have the, you know, bilingual education programs and staff that
still
they
not
need.
Equipped, really.
So, they did add some. They did add more in this budget, but to what extent that is, you know, I think it eased some of the crisis mode of last year, but to the extent that it's, you know, at the place it's supposed
we're
to be,
not all
we're
the
not
way
totally
there yet.
Sure.
Yeah.
And I do think that we will see, you did see the school board also approve recently in the wake of the election, its kind of commitment to being a sanctuary district and not allowing necessarily the Immigration Customs Enforcement into school buildings.
Yeah, that's the thing, because with Donald Trump's victory, CPS is facing that possibility that the federal government may try to deport migrant students.
Right, and we did a lot of reporting about sort of how the district is, you know, how the district was and even the state was tracking and labeling migrant students, and there's not necessarily like, they don't ask for immigration status necessarily because of their sanctuary policies, but they also have these numbers of English language learners or, you know, Latino demographics that, you know, when you check the box that I'm this is my, you know, race
my
and ethnicity.
Right.
So they could kind of triangulate for us how many new migrants had arrived, but they were like, you know, we as a sanctuary district have not try not to ask specifically about their status. And so the tracking thing can be difficult. And I think that also raises questions if the federal government were to impose some sort of, again, you know, mandate around that or try to get public agencies to do enforcement. Mm-hmm. Like, there's that dance.
Mass deportation threat looms for sure. One last item that has gotten a lot of buzz this year, the sale of hemp-derived products. Probably the most well-known being that Delta 8, Mitch.
Right.
The governor finally waded into this long-running debate. What's happening?
Yeah, so you've got, this is like a political battle. It's been going on for 2 years or so versus basically big cannabis corporations. Illinois obviously legalized marijuana back in 2020. And the hemp-derived product industry, which is a pretty big industry, as it turns out. Under a federal bill that passed a few years back that legalized hemp, it basically inadvertently opened a loophole that allows people a lot smarter than I am in the laboratory to basically derive what behaves a lot like regular marijuana in terms mm-hmm. of its psychoactive effects into this thing they call D8 or Delta 9 is another variation. And basically, these are sold at gas stations, convenience stores everywhere, totally unregulated. There's no licensing process in the state. So it's something that Illinois and a lot of other states have been trying to sort of grapple with and failing to grapple with over the last few years. Governor Pritzker last week, he finally took the side basically of the big cannabis lobby, which is basically calling for these hemp businesses to go through the same expensive and stringent licensing process that they have to go through. This is something that the governor and again, the cannabis corporations are going to be pushing really hard to pass in early January. And when you've got Pritzker in your corner, that's usually a pretty good sign heading into lame duck.
. 2024 has been a tough year for Chicago sports. A Bears head coach fired, a mediocre basketball season, historical losses in baseball and hockey. So I turned to Mitch to reflect on the past year of sports.
I'm a big White Sox fan. Worst season in MLB history.
This was a tough
bit of a
one.
Damper.
Yeah.
And kind of adding insult to injury this month. The Cubs making a big splashy trade for Kyle Tucker, who's a superstar in the outfield. It's pretty dark times for all the teams.
Dark times, he says. A lot of attention, though, was on coaching. You know, both the Bears and Blackhawks got rid of coaches this season. So with these teams in turmoil, what is the likelihood that they're going to attract great coaches for next year?
It seems pretty low for a lot of these teams. I mean, especially a team like the Bears. I mean, the Bears have gone through this cycle, three times that I can think of, like, concretely in the last decade or so, where it's just sort of a cycle of, is it the quarterback? Is it the head coach? Is it the general manager?
Yeah.
Let's fire the
coach. Who
needs
to go?
Then let's fire the general manager. Then let's get a new quarterback. And then the cycle just sort of repeats itself.
And no one's meshing well together. And it's just
It just doesn't seem like a, it's not an organization that is primed for success. It doesn't seem like the most attractive job opportunity. And, you know, my thoughts go out to Will Venable, the new White Sox manager, who I'm very optimistic about. Seems like a great guy. Seems like a good spirit in the clubhouse. But I hope he can sort of weather the storm in the Jerry Reinsdorf organization.
Well, with all this chaos, they got the nerve to have this ongoing drama over potential stadium sites. I mean, mainly I'm talking about the Bears here, but also the Sox, right? What's the latest on the stadium saga?
Right. I mean, as much as futile as most teams in Chicago have been this year, they've kind of run into similar roadblocks off the field. The Bears have been kind of flirting with moving out to the suburbs for more than 3 years now, which is kind of wild to think. The White Sox kind of jumped into that early this year when they started floating the idea of a new publicly funded stadium in the South Loop. And basically the only lawmaker that they could get, or that only the White Sox could get to sort of back their plan, was Brandon Johnson, who, as we've very thoroughly discussed, has not got a lot of clout behind the scenes to make that happen. So it's, you know, we enter 2025 with equally low hopes. I should say the teams have low hopes or odds of making things happen in the new
this
year.
This is the part of the recap where things go down. I mean, David, what's on your mind? Because you're shaking your head there.
Yeah, I mean, the Bears got Mayor Johnson lined up for their big Soldier Field stadium idea, just building a brand new $4 billion stadium right south of Soldier Field. They're willing to kick in about $2 billion, which is not it's not inconsiderable.
It's not nothing.
But they also expect a lot of state support for it, and the state is unwilling. Governor Pritzker has been very firm. They're kind of plan Bs, both are quite interesting. The Arlington, the former Arlington racetrack site is still in play, and they've gotten some recent accommodations by the taxing authorities up there, the school districts in particular. And now the Michael Reese Hospital site, they've decided maybe can work after all, after saying it would not work, which is really the most interesting possibility, because it really would be an economic development opportunity. It would be a way to bring real economic development to that area around Brownsville. And
the Michael Reese site.
The Michael Reese site. Mm-hmm. I could see a way in which Governor Pritzker would be able to line up state support for that because of the economic development prospects. If the Bears really can make that site work, we may actually see a new stadium in Chicago.
Yeah, well, speaking of sites here, we've been reporting this year about massive changes coming to the South Side with the Quantum Computer Campus that's being greenlit. Now we're hearing the 400-acre site will be getting a new hospital.
Right, and we're seeing very quietly, because it just is so nerdy to talk about a quantum computing site where there used to be a steel mill, the Southworks steel mill, which shut down in the late 70s, early 80s. But this is a 400-acre site, southeast side of Chicago, that is going to be, as it's developed, on the cutting edge of the new computer revolution, quantum computing. Mm-hmm. And the Chicago's economic development people are setting this up as a globally competitive center of excellence in this growing field. And one of the signs of real kind of progress is this announcement by Advocate. It's part of a bigger kind of reshuffling of their hospital resources in the city. They're closing a 100-year-old hospital, Trinity Hospital, which had 205 beds in it. They're moving to a much smaller and more distributed approach to healthcare, part of which is building, I think it was a 55-bed hospital, I think, in adjacent to the new quantum computing campus,
okay,
which is a sign of there's going to be progress down there and there will be growth, and that area, which is now an industrial wasteland, may in fact become a center of technological evolution and probably a pretty decent place to live.
Yeah, well, the thing is, Chicagoans have been waiting a long time for this lakefront area to be redeveloped, right? Other proposals did not go through. That movie studio campus, remember that? That failed. I mean, does it seem then to you, it sounds like you're pretty optimistic that this latest development might be a reality.
It feels pretty real because now there's a plan that needs to go in front of the city council, but it's received a couple of prior approvals. The political weight that seems to be lining up behind this idea is more than we've seen behind any of the others that have been floated.
Yeah. So in other Southside development news, before we move on, the CTA says it's secured nearly $2 billion in federal dollars to extend that red line from 95th down to 130th Street. Are you confident that money will still be there after January? When does he get sworn in?
January 20th. Well, the city was very worried.
Wait, he's getting sworn in on MLK Day?
No, that can't be right. Yeah. I don't know. It's somewhere the third week of January.
Hold on a minute.
I apologize.
Breaking news.
Anyhow, the Johnson administration was very worried after the election that President Trump would pull that funding. And the Illinois congressional delegation was trying to do what they could. And the one thing that they could do is just get this locked in with the Biden administration, get it signed, sealed, and delivered. I would say it's signed and sealed. It's not yet fully delivered.
Not yet delivered.
President Trump is quite resourceful in kind of breaking the China and making things turn out as he wishes they might. So he could still follow this up somehow, but that's not for lack of effort on the part of leaders here in the city of Chicago, the congressional delegation, and the Biden administration to get this locked up before President Trump takes office. So it looks like this will happen, and it's been in the works for 20-plus years,
right,
and should be good for economic development.
It's going to take another 20 to finish. No, I'm kidding.
Right.
Columbia College, Becky.
Yes.
The school's announced it's eliminating 25 full-time faculty and 11 programs. Mm-hmm. A lot of turmoil happening over there, so just walk us through.
Sure.
What's
going on? It's I should preface this with saying, you know, this story is, I think, a local example of something that I think can happen all over and has happened all over, because college enrollment really has taken a dip and certainly did during the COVID years, which really left a lot of universities and a lot of higher education with trying to figure out budgets.
Yeah.
Columbia College, the Chicago Tribune reported excellently about this total kind of overhaul, and they're doing some consolidation. They're going to go from 58 undergraduate degrees down to 33. That's almost half of, you know, that's halving their offerings. I know one that's significant is ASL that's gotten some attention. It's
yes.
the only ASL
The only bachelor's degree
in the state that will be eliminated. And, you know, the interim leader over there has said that this is a way for them to, again, consolidate and ensure future stability and respond to both enrollment changes and what the kind of job market is demanding. So they've really kind of taken a deep look. But, of course, you know, this is not coming without pain and concern. And I think a lot of, you know, folks, existing students, alum, and staff and faculty are, you know, trying to get through the other side of it and hopefully come out
for
stronger.
Sure. But yeah. Yesterday, Amazon delivery drivers in Skokie went on strike with drivers from six other Amazon sites around the country. Starting today, some Starbucks baristas in Chicago, LA, and Seattle are also on strike. Their union said that they'll be striking through Christmas Eve. And we saw a lot of support this year, David, for the labor movement, especially coming out of the pandemic, not just this year. Did unions sort of maintain the momentum, you think?
Yeah, I think the unions are building momentum. They're moving into services industries that they used to not be able to penetrate. The fact that they are getting some traction with both Amazon and Starbucks,
yeah,
those are two of the stalwarts of kind of the non-union segment of our economy. And they have a long ways to go.
Right.
Amazon.
But it feels like we'll continue to see strong support for labor unions in 2025.
Broad public support for labor unions in a way that we haven't seen in some years. Yes.
Something else that we haven't seen throughout the year: President-elect Donald Trump filing lawsuits against the media. We saw a lot of that, actually. In October, he sued CBS's 60 Minutes over an interview with Vice President Kamala Harris. Last week, ABC settled a defamation suit for Trump from Trump. This was for $15 million. The latest lawsuit came on Monday when Trump sued the Des Moines Register for a poll that showed that he was behind Harris. Reactions?
No, I think it just sort of underscores how careful we in the media need to be in reporting. You know, this.
And we are pretty careful. We don't want to get things wrong. And when we do, what do? We generally issue a retraction. And, you know, most people don't sue over that.
Right. I mean, it's, you know, we're obviously striving for perfection. You're never going to get it. And, you know, folks are entitled to file suit in court. I think what we really need to watch out for and be vigilant against is, you know, predatory lawsuits that are just seeking to chill media reporting on powerful people. I don't think that's going to happen here. But yeah, I mean, that when you've got a president-elect sort of declaring that he's going after the media
right,
directly for many years, now he's doing it a little bit more frequently in the courtroom. I think it's troubling.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's concern about ABC settling that case and for $15 million or so.
Right.
ABC argues, you know what, we probably would have lost it. It would probably might have said bad precedents. I mean, I'm not saying quite so many words, but that's the message they're conveying. Mm-hmm. The Des Moines Register sounds like it's going to fight this suit. What we have to be looking for is not just the harassment of these costly suits, mm-hmm. Some of which are he doesn't have much of a case, as in the Des Moines Register case. But there's a bigger push, not just to be intimidating, but also to go after at the Supreme Court level some of the protections that journalists have. In particular, there's a case, New York Times versus Sullivan, that gives us the right to shield our sources from inquiring minds that in government and elsewhere that maybe we've written about. And President Trump has made clear, and he has allies on the Supreme Court who also seem inclined to eliminate that protection.
Right.
And in addition to kind of diminishing our stature, the stature of journalism in our society, there is a pending attack on some of the rights.
Well,
that
I just hope that this doesn't become a trend. Now we're just about out of time. And as we head off into the holidays, folks, I did want to ask if there were good news stories that really stayed with any of you this year. I'm thinking right off the bat of a story that Mitchell Armantrout reported on recently about Illinois' first drive-through DMV kiosk opening up in Lombard. Yes. I've had many DMV nightmares. I know that you have too. Waiting, just a kiosk drive-through, it just sounds like a dream.
Yeah, put them everywhere, not only in Lombard, right?
Put them everywhere.
Yeah, drive all the
but Lombard. We'll have to leave it there. Share your thoughts with me later on Slack. That's it for the weekly news recap, not just for this week, but for 2024. My thanks to Chalk Beach Chicago's Becky Vivi, the Better Government Association's David Greising, and Mitchell Armantrout of the Sun Times. Happy holidays.
You too.
You
Happy
too,
everyone.
This episode of the Reset Podcast was produced by Andrea Guthman. It was edited by Dan Tucker and mixed by Linnea Dominic. Join us here every Friday for our weekly news recap. And don't forget to subscribe so that you never miss the next one. I'm Sasha Ann Simons. Thanks for listening. Have a great weekend and safe travels if you are traveling leading up to the holidays.
I love how WBEZ shows different sides of the story. I never feel like it's too polarized, and I think the reporters do an excellent job of trying to get the full story, trying to show different other sides. I'm often, when I'm listening to public radio, think in my mind, well, what about X? Or like, I have another question. Or like, have they thought about X? And most of the time, WBEZ thinks about all of it, which I really appreciate.